Welcome to the Memorial Day episode of Vet Story. I'm your host, Phil Briggs. And while much of America gets ready for a long weekend, a backyard barbecue, and some time with family and friends, it's also a weekend where we're encouraged to take a moment to pause from our own life and think about those that gave theirs. Now, every year in Washington, D.C., tens of thousands of people crowd downtown in the shadow of the Washington Monument on the National Mall for the National Memorial Day concert. This year will be no exception. There's an all-star lineup featuring distinguished guests like General Colin Powell, performances by Academy Award, Golden Globe, and Emmy Award-winning actress Allison Janney, Grammy Award nominee Leona Lewis, Gary Sinise and the Lieutenant Dan Band, and musical tributes from the U.S. Army Herald Trumpets, the U.S. Army Chorus, the U.S. Navy Sea Chanters, the U.S. Air Force Singing Sergeants, and the Armed Forces Color Guard. But on this episode of Vet Story, we wanted to find guests that would capture the real meaning behind Memorial Day. And the organizers of the National Memorial Day concert granted us three interviews. The stories these three men will tell will transport you to battlefields far away and will literally capture the spirit that is Memorial Day.
Okay, my name is Joseph L. Anello, Command Sergeant Major, U.S. Army, retired. I live in Castle Rock, Colorado right now.
My name is Hiroshi Miyamura. I go by Hershey here in Gallup. That was the nickname given to me by a school teacher.
Joe and Hershey will be honored at the 2018 National Memorial Day concert, but their story began in the spring of 1951. This is an excerpt from the article at PBS.org entitled Korean War, The Bonds of Service. Just before midnight on April 24th, Chinese soldiers stormed the U.S. camp in never-ending waves. Outgunned and outmanned, the U.S. forces fought until they had no choice but to withdraw. Those who could not escape were taken prisoner. Among those American soldiers captured by the Chinese were best friends Hiroshi Hershey Miyamura and Joe Anello. During the attack, Hiroshi heroically fought against the Chinese forces, allowing for his squad to safely withdraw, as he and Joe were taken prisoner. Hiroshi suffered painful wounds, but none so bad as Joe. The blast from a grenade had injured his spine, and he was unable to walk. For miles, Hiroshi carried Joe as they marched until the Chinese soldiers forced Hiroshi at gunpoint to leave Joe on the side of the road to die. And there, they said what they thought was their final goodbye.
That night, Hershey squad and my squad were assigned to Fox Company of the 2nd Battalion, 7th Regiment. Before we got dug in, you know, the infantrymen, our machine guns are placed between them and in the best area on sight, to give us defensive fire to protect the infantrymen around us. Well, as we were getting ready to dig in, a battalion intelligence officer, I use that intelligence in quotes, came down and told the Fox Company commander that the British Marines, which to our west are about 2 miles, right on the Injun River, were taking a beating. And they were, Phil. So they're going to take all of Fox Company out to go help the British Marines. But they were leaving our guns in place. So we had Hershey squad, my squad, 22 people scattered for about 300 yards with no protection in between us. All the riflemen were gone.
Oof.
But they assured us that there was no activity to our immediate front. So, you know, we were in good shape. However, they failed to inform the Chinese of this, because that night about 10 o'clock, all along this imaginary line I told you about,
Yeah. They
had 6 Chinese divisions attacked our fronts. And, of course, we, with 22 people, we were immediately, you know, engulfed. My squad was hit first. I was on just a little lower level than Hershey was. He was a little higher on my left flank. And we were immediately, you know, surrounded. It was kind of chaotic, a lot of fighting, a lot of hand-to-hand type activity. And I was going back to my section leader's foxhole to try to get some flares coming in because it was kind of dark, you know. We wanted to have more light. And about that time, I got shot in the back of my legs. As I was going down, I got hit by a hand grenade. And that was essentially the end of the war for me. I just kind of went out, nice, quiet, warm feeling. And I woke up the next morning being prodded by a bayonet from a Chinese soldier. And he had asked me in sign language to get up, and I couldn't move. So two Chinese soldiers grabbed one arm apiece, and they dragged me off this mountain. And had the worst, the roughest ride I ever had in my life.
I bet.
But anyway, I got down to a schoolyard, I believe it was. And fortunately for me, and thank God, my friend Hershey, he was slightly wounded, but he took care of my wounds as best he could with, you know, the equipment we had. We had the little sulfur packs and, you know, and the bandages and all that. And he tried to stench the flow of blood, and he did a good job because I was bleeding pretty badly. In any event, about an hour later, we had a Chinese officer came into the courtyard, got up in a little box, and he spoke in a very Oxford English accent, telling us that we would be well treated, wounds would be taken care of, we would be fed, and our families would be notified through our division that we were prisoners of war. Well, 2 seconds after he left, they stole my ring, my watch, and my other personal items. And not only me, but everybody else. But he had also informed us the next morning we were going to go on a forced march for about 100 miles to a prisoner of war camp. Well, that was a problem for me because I couldn't walk. The next morning we got up, Hershey, I put all my weight on Hershey, and my left side was okay, but my right side was completely immobile. Anyway, Hershey carried me this way for about 10 miles, kind of dragging me, if you will.
God bless.
Yeah. He'll dispute the distance we have over the last 68 years. So we've agreed that it was a long way.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the interesting part comes.
Well, you know, when I was told by an interpreter to leave him because we were holding up the column, I hesitated, but the Josie insisted I leave him, so I had left him at the roadside there, never expected to see him again, because I thought for sure once I left him, they would shoot him. So I just went on, and I often wondered what happened afterward. How I made it, I'll never know, but when we finally did reach our destination, it was no better than the conditions, the food, the medical attention was the same. No medical attention. The food was non-existent, really, because we weren't getting that much, except for a cup of soybean milk in the morning, and then watered the vegetable with maybe a vegetable during the day, and that was it. And that went on for a year, over a year. And the thing is, they would not release the names of us that were captured. So 1 year, my wife didn't know whether I was alive or not, because the War Department declared me as missing.
I laid there for about a day and a half under this imaginary tree. And another Chinese unit came by that was being pushed back by our forces that was recapturing the areas that we had lost. And they saw me, and they prodded me with a bayonet, you know, to see if I was alive. And unfortunately, at that time for them, I was. they put me on a buggy with big bicycle wheels on it, and it took me up north of about, I'd say 40 kilometers, 50 kilometers, and that's about right where the DMZ is right now, right on the Injun River. I was there with four other people, and four Americans and one Turkish soldier, all severely wounded. In fact, the Americans were more severely wounded than I was. Also, they brought in a pilot that they had shot down, and his right hand was burned out to the bone. There was no hardly any meat on it. He tried to level off his aircraft. He got shot in a belly tank, and the flames were coming up there and burned off his hand. Oh. But fortunately for us, he was the only one that could walk. Now, ironically, we were in a forward Chinese medical unit, the people that were responsible for us. But they refused to treat our wounds. They wouldn't feed us. They were just warehousing us until we died, Phil. But they did allow this pilot to walk around the area and barter with the local farmers for food and whatever he could get from them. They didn't have much themselves. Anyway, we had one fellow that was actually the least wounded of us all. He had a clean bullet hole through his ankle. But it got infected, and he developed gangrene. We pleaded with the Chinese, you know, to do something for him, but they refused. In fact, we went so far as to ask them to give us surgical or sharp instruments, and we were going to attempt to amputate his leg. Now, we didn't know anything about, you know, that, but we would probably end up killing him, but we just couldn't stand to see him laying there dying. And he did die about 3 days later, and this was we were in captivity then about three and a half weeks. And the pilot and I was able to crawl around, move the body out of this. We were in a Korean kitchen. We moved the body out of a Korean kitchen, and about 5 yards away, we put him in a what they call a kimchi hole. I don't know if you know what that is, Phil. It's an area where the Korean store that went to kimchi.
Oh, okay.
And it had a cover on it made out of wood and vines and all that stuff there. And getting back to the kitchen we were in, it was about 5x8. And the reason we were in the kitchen, because they had horses and mules in the house. And the reason for that is so the aircraft wouldn't see them when they flew over. But the horses were kicking down the plaster walls. They were crapping all over us. And that brought the flies, and the flies, brought the maggots.
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of disgusting at the time. But we found out later that the maggots probably saved our lives there because they ate all of the dead flesh. So it was good to know after. I didn't know it at the time. Anyway, I talked to the pilot. We had two guys there that probably wouldn't have lasted more than 2 or 3 weeks. I told him we had to do something. We just can't sit around, you know, and watch everybody die. And he agreed. So we formulated a plan, and we talked to the remaining troops there and told them what we wanted to do. And they all agreed 100%. Because the reason we talked to them, we didn't know what the Chinese would do if they found one of us missing. Anyway, that night we crawled up to the hillside with some rice straw. And we built a POW sign with an arrow pointing down to the house. And we came back, and the following day, toward in the evening, he went down to the Injun River, ostensibly to get water for us, and he kept on going. And before he left, he told me, "Joe, if you don't get help within 3 days, I want you to try to get down there somehow." And I told him I could swim like a fish. I'm born and raised in Boston at the corner of the Charles River and the Atlantic Ocean, and I've been swimming since I was 6 years old. But he thought he was stronger than I, and he was going to go first. Anyway, he left and swam down the Indian River for about 2 days. Mike made contact with a Korean organization, and they turned him over to the 1st Cavalry Division. And he told the 1st Cavalry Division, the commander, where we were, and He gave him the approximate coordinates and so forth. Anyway, true to what he said, about 3 days later, in the morning, a flight of Corsairs from the aircraft carriers off the coast came in and just devastated the hills around our house because the Chinese were in positions around there. And about an hour later, the five tanks from the 1st Cavalry Division, the 5th Cavalry Regiment, came in, surrounded our house, put us on top of the tanks on the leeward side, backed off about 100 yards, turned around, and we headed home, and we were free. The happiest day of my life.
Of the peace talks, that went on for over 2 years. And finally, on the last month of the 53, in August, last week of August, we were told to gather in an area, and then when you hear your name be called, you'll be going home within a week. So as the time went by, there was about 25 of us left, and we finally got our call to go back, be released in August 20, 1953.
The phone calls I shared with both of those gentlemen were easily 45 minutes long, and I had to condense it down a little bit to get it to fit within this podcast. But what I took away from my time with each of them was an incredible feeling, a feeling that you can survive and you can will yourself to live through anything. They saw firsthand the cost of war. They survived POW camps and made it safely back to the good old USA. But there's one part of the story that still remains, how they finally found each other again.
I had orders to go to California to attend the Army Language School.
I was waiting for a job to open up at the Wingate Ordnance Depot.
Anyway, I jumped in my car and I headed down to Gallup on my way to San Francisco, not San Francisco, Monterey. And I walked in, I found out what Hershey was working. I walked in the store.
Joe came in, walked through the door, and I couldn't believe when I saw him that he was alive.
He looked at me, he turned white as a sheet. He said, "My God,
you're dead."
I said, no, I'm not, Hershey. I assured him I was still alive.
I don't remember saying that, but I just couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Anyway, that's how I found out he was alive, and he found out I was alive. And him, his wife, and his family, and my wife have been friends now for, 68 years.
One of the other honored guests of the National Memorial Day concert is a Marine whose story begins during some of the darkest times of the Vietnam War.
William B. Ryder, founder of American Combat Veterans of War, a 501c3 nonprofit. I enlisted in the Marine Corps in January 1965 and separated from the United States Marine Corps December 31st, 1968, from the Bethesda Naval Hospital.
And to that, I will give you the oorah. Although I'm
thanks, buddy.
I'm Navy, but we're the same department. And
hey, you guys helped us. I actually lost three corpsmen in like 15 minutes.
Oh, God bless.
Yeah. No, they were great.
And it is because of your rich experience and because of the things you've managed to live through by divine providence, I might add, really underscore the importance of Memorial Day. But if I could, Bill, can I read in a little bit from your bio? And just
sure.
Have you pick
absolutely.
Up kind of where I leave off. But in 1968, there was the pause in the Vietnam War to observe the Lunar New Year, or Tet. And in spite of that agreement, the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong troops launched a surprise full-scale attack on cities across South Vietnam. And one of the targets, of course, is the legendary Khe San in the Quang Tri province, where 40,000 enemy troops faced 2,500 Marines. And you were part of a very famous division in military history, probably one of the most renowned divisions that we speak of when we talk about Memorial Day. But among those fighting at Khe San was the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, also referred to as the Walking Dead.
because of the highest casualty rate in Marine Corps history. Share with me just a little something, anything you could, about your experience there and kind of how it shaped the significance of Memorial Day to you.
Yeah, sure. That's a good question, and one that sometimes is a little hard to answer, but Memorial Day is every day for me, and I'll tell you why. So many young men, some very promising young men, lost their lives on the battlefield, on the mountains, in the valleys, in the Triple Canopy, at Quezon Airstrip, and it's always been my perspective that they should be remembered. We should talk about who they were and describe how and willing they were to lay their life down for their fellow combat brother. There was some kind of mystique about that. They wouldn't talk about what happened. And I think in the parlance of society, it was a club, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
A very visceral, traumatic club. And they didn't talk about it. Sometimes they cried. Mm-hmm. It's because of their brothers that were left lying on the battlefield.
Of the nearly 3,000 Marines who served with the 1-9 in Vietnam, 25% would be killed in action.
On one particular day, we lost 45 to 50 killed on a hill and over 150 wounded. That was on April the 16th, which was on a what we call, referred to as a hill with no name, right outside of the Quezon Airstrip.
Now, it's understandable that surviving those situations will leave an indelible mark on you, visible or invisible.
And they were afraid, actually, in those days to talk to combat veterans because we were, quote-unquote, killers, and you don't want to set them off. And that's what we really, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, had to deal with.
So as Bill went down the road of his own healing process to recover from the often misunderstood diagnosis of PTSD, he began to understand the nature of healing.
It's when you don't talk about your trauma. It's when you stuff it that you're going to have problems, because early on we discovered that the ones who had severe post-traumatic stress, and it was called something different in those days, were the World War II and Korean War guys. They were a mess. And quite frankly, some of them are still a mess. It's what you have to talk about, and certainly talk about with somebody who has been there and done that and can relate.
And relate is exactly what Bill Ryder did. Inspired by his journey, he founded the American Combat Veterans of War, a nonprofit with the mission to help those veterans who have experienced the same trauma of war he has.
Well, we have several programs. One of them is, as I said, the Safe Warrior Outreach, in which we have meetings every Tuesday at our Carlsbad office. And pizza is served, and serenity is to be given. And we also help with a young Marine that we mentored at some point, and he works for Challenged Athletes and also has a program with the Balboa Naval Hospital, which is the surf clinic where Marines and veterans who have lost their limbs are encouraged to come and get on a surfboard and do things that they thought they could never do if they had lost a leg or an arm or both. And it's quite uplifting, something that really moves your heart and wants to be part of. We also go into the Vista Detention Center, and I don't know whether you know this or not, but the United States has a lot of veterans warehoused in jail and in prison, and for various reasons. But in Vista, there is two incarcerated veteran mods, exclusively veterans, and they need to be re-energized. They need to be rebooted. And we go in and tell them that the moment they're proudest of, when they held their hand up to and swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States, that can be theirs again. And we mentor them, and we do everything we can, and they're I couldn't possibly tell you everything we did for them, but we encouraged them to become part of the societal conversation again, to care about who they are. And we have lowered the recidivism rate dramatically from around 75% to below 10%. That's astonishing. That's the answer, because most of them are in there for drinking and DUIs and drugs and domestic violence, which is the result of being traumatized in the service. Don't they deserve what is a major tenet of most religions, and that's redemption? I think so.
We'd like to thank all of our guests, Joe Anello, Hiroshi Hershey Miyamura, and Bill Ryder. Their stories help us remember the sacrifices made for our freedoms today. I'm Phil Briggs, and I'll talk to you again with more great stories from the battlefield to the barstool on the next episode of Vet Story.